First, I wanted to really thank an architecture and performer for laying on these 10 days. It's been extremely constructive for us. I think it's a great idea to bring together people from social movements and also to interweave with that the few progressive academics that are around so that we can have a constructive conversation. We've been trying to do some of that sort of thing at the CUNY Grad Center, and it's good to see that there is much more getting together in general now than there has been, I think, for many years. And I think there's a much greater sense that it's about time we did something, that Obama's not going to do it unless he's pushed, and we need to do a good deal of pushing. And I think to the degree that some of the conversation over the week has focused on the idea that maybe next May, beginning May 1st, there will be simultaneous actions by many groups in many cities to try to take back the city, take back the land, or liberate spaces, that this may be eventually considered a foundational outside agitator conference, which has actually helped initiate that movement. The movement, it seems to me, also is beginning to regather its strength. We have, I just mentioned this, some flyers here on November 30th at the Graduate Center at 6:30, we're going to do an event commemorating the 10th anniversary of the Battle for Seattle. Several of the original organizers of the events in Seattle are going to be there talking about what they did, how they did it, and where we go now in terms of what the global justice movement will be about. And I think that linking together the global movement with, if you like, the urban-based movements is going to be very important. The global perspectives were opened up a bit yesterday when it became clear that Take Back the Land is much inspired, if you will, by the MST in Brazil and by social movements in Durban. And therefore, I think this cross-fertilization across oceans is actually a very important dynamic, which needs to be encouraged. And again, I want to thank you and thank An Architecture for setting up a situation where we can continue this discussion, and I hope we will continue it over the next few months. About a year or so ago, I was with a group of students, and they asked me, was I anti-capitalist? And I said, well, yeah, of course. And you know, but then they said, well, what are you for? And I've just been writing an introduction to the Pluto edition of the Communist Manifesto, and I've been very impressed with the idea that the Communist Manifesto, that as they put it there, the communists have no party. They just happen to be all of those people who see that the world is heading in the wrong direction and who are going to act in such a way as to try to set it right. And so in light of that, when they said, what was I for? I said, well, I guess I'm a communist. And the shock that came over everybody's faces was just enormous. So I recovered quickly and said, well, actually, I'm an eco-communist. And everybody felt better. It's amazing what the word eco does. And so salving everybody, oh, God, it's not, can't be a real. But actually, right now, of course, amongst some philosophers like Badiou and so on, there is this kind of question, in the same way that people started to discuss in the 1990s, is another capitalism possible? Is there another world possible? So this may be an interesting moment even to talk about the question, is another communism possible? And if so, what would it look like and how would it be? And I don't think we should necessarily shy away from that. But then, when I was thinking further about this, I was asked again to say, well, why was I so anti-capitalist? And what was wrong with capitalism? And there were a number of things that struck me. And just putting it in the contemporary circumstances, I was struck by the fact that just last week there was this report that came out in the United States that said nearly 50 million people don't have enough food to eat reasonably well. And if that's the situation in the United States, imagine what it's like in the rest of the world. And I'm old enough to remember back in 1974 there was a conference on global hunger in Rome, and Henry Kissinger declared that within 10 years everybody would have enough to eat. And this actually came after, in the 1960s, the United Nations actually set up the whole kind of notion that the 1960s was going to be a development decade which would eradicate poverty by the end of the decade. It didn't work, so they commissioned the man, ex-Prime Minister of Canada, Lester Pearson, to do a report in the late 1960s. Where he defined a second development decade of the 1970s, which was going to eradicate poverty by the end of that decade. If you go to the millennium meetings of all the world's leaders, they also promised they would eradicate poverty by 2015, and we're, of course, nowhere near that at all. Now, the point about this is that actually being anti-poverty is the wrong thing. That actually you can't be anti-poverty and pro-capitalist. And in fact, over this last 50, 60 years, we've lived under the illusion that somehow or other the means, capitalistic means, could actually realize the noble end of the end of poverty and the end of inequality and all the rest of it. And I think actually we're wrong, you know, to be anti-poverty is just the wrong thing. We have to be anti-capitalist. Because we have to challenge those means, because those means, as Marx pointed out long ago in Capital, inevitably produce inequality. That freely functioning markets produce tremendous concentrations of wealth at one end of the scale and tremendous concentrations of misery and poverty and all the rest of it at the other end of the scale on the part of those who actually produce all the wealth. And I think it's very significant that even in these really miserable times, the number of billionaires in India has doubled in just 1 year. That neoliberalism, when it came to Mexico, produced 14 billionaires in about, you know, 6 years. That again and again and again, as we turn to these mechanisms which are supposed to deliver us freedom from poverty and want and hunger, then what in fact those mechanisms do is to produce poverty, misery and hunger. And that therefore anti-capitalism means to find entirely different mechanisms to those which we're being prescribed on an almost daily basis. There are other sort of more narrow reasons why I think being anti-capitalist becomes crucial. There was a discussion here the other night in which somebody who lived in the neighborhood kind of said, we went through this big struggle at the end of the 1970s to get the loft law to apply to this area in the hope that many of us would be able to use some of the loft spaces and turn them into reasonable living. The trouble with that was that the people who struggled for that, who imagined this space and this place to be a very, very different kind of one, actually soon found themselves forced out by the rental mechanisms and all the market mechanisms, and as the person kind of said the other night, I don't recognize the place now. It's completely gone, it's got gentrified. And you'll find cases of this sort again and again and again. When I was in Berlin last summer, there's a little area in Hamburg, the São Paulo district of Hamburg, which I'm sure many of you know. And in the São Paulo district, they had a very, very long struggle to prevent the developers taking it over and wrecking it. And they'd succeeded in keeping the developers out. And all those parts of Hamburg that the developers managed to take over, they wrecked and turned into incredibly boring spaces. But they've now found, actually, the São Paulo district is the most interesting place in Hamburg. So they've now selected little, they're now beginning to sort of take over small buildings and actually sell them at a premium. In other words, what they're doing is to taking the cultural vibrancy and all of that which is produced by this local neighborhood movement and appropriate it and commodify it for their own particular benefit. And you can find examples of this again and again and again wherever you go in the city. And there's a very interesting line in Henri Lefebvre's The Urban Revolution, in which he kind of says, you know, social movements can take over a place for a while, and they can do something very different in that place. But what you always have to watch out for is how quickly and how soon those liberated spaces can be reabsorbed into the dominant praxis. And this reabsorption back into the dominant praxis would be true of the factory takeovers in Argentina. It's true of places like the São Paulo kind of area, the Dumbos and the, you know, and Soho's and all that in New York City. Now, what that says is, well, if that's going to happen all of the time, and indeed it happens so much, it doesn't, you know, there are some circumstances where it doesn't, but most of the time it does. If that's a problem, then we should be paying attention to the dominant praxis. The radical practice has to actually confront the dominant practice, rather than actually imagining that somehow or other you can carve out some such a heterotopic space and remain protected, as it were, from this dominant praxis. So there's another reason, if you like, why I think it's very important to be anti-capitalist. But for me, there's an even more compelling reason. And I think that we really have to take this one very, very, very seriously. The capitalism is a system which is based upon compound growth. Typically, it grows at 3% per year when it's in good, reasonably good shape. Actually, historically, since around 1750, all the data that's been assembled by some of the economic historians show that it's grown on average by 2.25% compound rate of growth since 1750. Now, 3% compound rate of growth means you've got to find 3% of this year's output as new investment. Right now, the calculus is that the global economy is about $55 trillion worth, which means that 3%, you're going to have to find at least $1.5 trillion of new investment opportunities in the next year if you want to keep the 3% growing. By the time you get to 2030, you're going to be talking about finding $3 trillion worth of new investment opportunities. Back in 1973, you had to find something like $0.45 trillion. In other words, what you're seeing here is an escalation of the investment problem of finding the new profitable investment opportunities for more and more and more capital. Put in physical terms, if you imagine capitalism as it was constituted in 1750, when it was really, you know, industrial capitalism was concentrated in sort of Manchester and a few villages around there, and Birmingham and a few other hotspots, and you thought about compound growth of 3% forever, you kind of say, well, it's not a problem. But now you're talking about 3% compound growth on what's going on in China, what's going on in most of East Asia, much of what's going on in South Asia and Indonesia. You're talking about much of what's going on in Latin America, or all of Europe, all of North America. Physically, just simply physically, this begins to look like a huge, huge problem. And part of the analysis I would have over the nature of the present crisis is that since around 1970, actually, capital has had more and more difficulty defining profitable venues for investment, in spite of the opening up of China. I mean, what would capitalism have done if China had not opened up, if the Soviet bloc had not collapsed? What would it have done? Where would it have gone? And even with that, it started to invest in asset values. Now, this is a very interesting feature because Ricardo, way, way back, predicted the end of capitalism because he said, well, in the end, people are going to just live off rents, and to the degree that rent actually rises, then actually what that means is that capital starts to disappear. And in effect, the rentier economy has become very much more important over the last 30 years, and asset values have become much more interesting to capitalists in terms of investment. If, as a capitalist, you can invest in production and get, say, 1 or 2 or 3% rate of profit, but you can go speculate in assets and get 5, 7, 8, 10% rate of profit, you're going to switch into asset value speculation. And that, of course, is what we've seen in property markets, stock markets, commodity futures. Now we're going to see it, of course, in climate change futures. I mean, everything's in the future. You can buy weather futures if you want, you know, so you know, go speculate in that market if you feel like it. So this is, if you like, another compelling reason why it seems to me that we may well be in this crisis at one of those inflection points in capitalism's history, where things are going to change, and they're going to change radically, and the big question is, which direction are they going to take? And plainly, we cannot go back to the sort of productionist capitalism of the 1950s and the 1960s with its Keynesianism attached. Plainly, there's something really sick and wrong about the kind of capitalism that's emerged since the 1970s, and we're now in this inflection moment. And then the big issue arises, well, what kind of capitalism will arise out of this, that where we are at now? Or is this a moment where we really have to think alternatives? And this is, of course, one of the things that the media does not want to discuss. Mainstream academia doesn't want to discuss. And nobody really wants to discuss it. And I think that one of the things we have to do is to start to put that on the agenda big time in all kinds of dimensions. And one of the problems, it seems to me, that we have on the left is sometimes we take the view that my dimension is the one that matters and yours doesn't. And it therefore is very important at this particular moment to start to say, what is it that we have in common? And what is it about your solutions which can contribute to a macro shift? And if we take the view that actually many of the different social movements are advocating rather different things, even within, say, the global justice movement or within the right to the city movement, and to what degree can those different elements be put together in a rather kind of broader configuration? And that's the question that I was really asked to try to talk about a little bit on this occasion. To do that, it seems to me it's very important to have some kind of general theory of social change. And me being sort of a boring old Marxist, I turn to Marx and say, well, what theory of social change is there actually within Marx's Capital? And there's a very interesting one there if you're prepared to kind of read Capital in a certain way. And this occurred to me very explicitly in an urban context about 3 or 4 years ago when I was invited actually to chair a jury in South Korea on building a new city in South Korea. When they first invited me, I thought they got the wrong person, and I thought it was a joke. But they wanted me to go. And so in the end, I thought, well, they just wanted to rubber stamp what the construction companies want and all that sort of thing, and I wasn't going to do that. But I was intrigued, and I thought, well, I've never done this sort of thing, so why don't I go and see what happened? So I went. And there were all of these proposals, ideas for construction of a new city. The city was going to be about 500,000 people. It was going to house all of the administrative functions of the central government. Initially, it was going to be a capital city, but constitutional reasons prevented it from being that. And we were taken to the site and went around the site, and then we looked at all of the designs. And our task was not to select a design for the city, but to select ideas about designs which might be incorporated in the ultimate construction of the city. The city is now actually being built. Now, we thought it very important to sit down amongst us to discuss the criteria we might use. And the jury was made up of some very well-known architects and designers, international, Korean planners and some engineers and the like. And I was the only social scientist, if you like, on the whole thing. And we sat down and started discussing the different designs. And very soon it got into a huge debate between Isozaki and Winnie Maas over the question of the relative strengths of squares and circles as symbolic meanings and as being able to accommodate expansionist forces and all the rest of it. And actually, I'm trivializing it a bit because I tend to do that with these folk. But I kind of said, well, this talk about squares and circles is all very interesting, but I think there's actually another set of criteria we should use. First, we should have a real serious debate over the question of what kind of technologies are we going to actually embed in this urban environment, household technologies, waste disposal technologies, transport technologies, all the rest of it. What kind of technological mix is going to dominate? And how is that technological mix going to be actually configured in the city? So I thought the technological question was a big one that we should be seriously thinking about. And then said there's another element in here, which is what kind of relation to nature are we proposing here? And there's everything from the carbon footprint to the aesthetics of nature. I mean, Koreans don't like building on tops of hills, so if you try to build hilltop villages or something like that, you have a kind of cultural disaster on your hand. And so that what kind of aesthetics and what kind of, you know, what kind of, and how would the metabolism of the city work? Those were seemed to me a whole bunch of important issues, and those issues were not independent of the technology. Obviously, the selection of the technology and the metabolic kind of relations in the city were going to be very much codependent upon each other. And I then said, well, we also have to think about the dominant forms of social relations in this city. Obviously, this is going to be dominated by a bureaucratic, technocratic, scientific elite, which guarantees it's going to be one of the most boring places on Earth. So can we construct something which actually hides all of those ministries so you don't even know you're in a city with full of all of these ministerial kinds of things and turn it into a place that looks like it's actually kind of interesting to go to? Otherwise, you could see very clearly what was going to happen. People were going to spend a week down there, then they're going to hightail it back to Seoul for the weekends and all the rest of it. So there's a whole kind of question of the social relations and how what the relations were going to be between that scientific elite and those who were provisioning the city, what kind of gender relations were going to be there, what was, you know. So then that spilled over, if you like, into daily life questions. How would daily life be lived? How would people raise their kids? What would street life be like? Would you be talking about community organization, you know, all those kinds of things? So there's a whole set of questions about social relations and daily life, and clearly the technologies of the relation to nature were also codependent upon the social relations and the daily and the daily life. And then, of course, there's the question of how production got organized. What kind of production was going to go on in that place? Was there going to be, I mean, obviously there's going to produce scientific knowledge and bureaucratic decision making, and there's going to be a lot of waste paper, so maybe we should have a waste cycling plant in the middle of the city or something of that kind. These are the sorts of issues, again, in terms of the productive apparatus, exactly how would that be embedded in the city? And what? So I was going around across all of these different points and saying, we've got to think about all of these elements as they work together, including, of course, the administrative structure, the degree of democratic decision-making that could exist, what kind of institutional arrangements would exist, would you talk about community associations, would you be talking about neighborhood organization, you know, all those sorts of questions. So I kind of said we should actually be thinking about all of these elements together. And when we're thinking about the city, you shouldn't think about it as something as a completed object. You should think about it as something that could have the capacity to grow across all of these dimensions, that new technologies could be defined, new social relationships set up, and so we should think of it as something that has an open set of possibilities. So I was sort of talking along these lines, and we had an interesting discussion about all of this for about, you know, 15, 20 minutes, and then one of the architects kind of said, well, this is all very well, but it's really, really much too complicated. Only one of these things really matters, and that's the one issue that I have not mentioned so far, which is the mental conceptions of the world, the political subjectivities of the world, how people thought about the world. And he said, the only thing that really matters here is the mental conceptions. And actually, in mental conceptions, it's the symbolic that really matters. And actually, the real thing about the symbolic is the difference between circles and squares. So we got back to circles and squares again, and that was it. Well, that evening, we were sitting around the table, and somebody said to me, you know, what you're talking about is really interesting. Have you written it up? Where'd you get it from? And I made a big mistake, which I should never have made. I said, well, actually, it's a footnote in chapter 15 of Marx's Capital, volume 1. Now, when you say something like that, you get two reactions. One is to say, Marx? He's in the room? The spectre has arrived? Oh, my God. You know, can I get out of here before I lose my job and all my contracts and all this kind of stuff? I mean, it's just an amazing kind of thing. So there's a sort of fear. The other thing is to look at you like you're a complete and utter idiot, because all you do, obviously, is to go around spouting lines out of Marx. And in this case, it's even worse. You're spouting footnotes out of Marx. But I thought this was so they wouldn't talk to me after that. You know, I mean, it really was. I was chair of the jury, so it was very difficult, you know, to discuss with me at all. And afterwards, I was talking to the guy who was in charge of all of this, and I said, well, you know, this has been very difficult. I said, I wondered why you got me here, because, you know, you've built 20 new cities in Korea over the last, you know, 30 years. And I said, you know, all of them are absolutely lousy. And he said, well, yes, I know, I built them. And he said, but we thought we had an opportunity in this case to actually do something different, which was precisely why we wanted you to come and try and stir the pot a little. But the point I would like to make about this is that embedded in this is a general theory of social change. The way I would put it sort of technically is to kind of say, imagine each one of these elements I've talked about as moments in a general kind of process. There's a technological moment, there's a relation to nature moment, there's a social relations moment, there's a daily life moment, there's a mental conceptions and production moment. And all of these moments actually are integral to each other. That actually social change does not occur by one of these moments actually pulling everything into order. Social change occurs through interactions going on across all of these different moments. And what that says to me is that if you look very carefully at, for instance, Marx's chapter on machinery and industry, a lot of it is about the dynamics of how a new technology came into being by interaction across all of those different moments. The production system changed, the mental conceptions of the world changed, the social relations changed, and then the technology could change, and of course the relation to nature changed. In other words, the technology couldn't change without all of the other elements changing also. So what Marx does in his theory of the transition, if you like, from feudalism to capitalism, is to look at a co-evolutionary process. So what that says to me is, if we're going to talk about the transition from capitalism to communism, or eco-communism, I better call it, just so you don't freak out too, if we're going to do that, then we have to think about it in very much the same kind of way. We have to think about a co-revolutionary process. And that co-revolutionary process is one in which we start to look at all of those elements and how they work. Now, it's very interesting, when you go off and you start looking at the literature right now, you'll find all of these elements at some point, usually one of them is picked on as if it's a silver bullet. And it's particularly interesting to read the bourgeois literature on these lines. I mean, you go off and you read Tom Friedman. Now, what does Tom Friedman say? Technological change, which is in the book in the Vanguard. And at some point in there, he kind of says, well, you know, I've been accused of being a technological determinist, and I plead guilty. And he said, and then somebody told me that Marx was a technological determinist, in which case, says Tom Friedman, I guess I'm a Marxist. Of course, Marx is not a technological determinist, which is, you know, precisely my point, but the point is that Friedman's interpretation is almost entirely led technologically. You go to something like, Guns, Germs, and Steel, a big book by Jared Diamond, when basically he says it's the relation to nature which matters. I mean, everything that goes on in the world has to do with, if you like, the geographical and natural basis of determinism. And everything else is kind of marginalized in his account. And you put sort of Friedman next to Jared Diamond, and you kind of say, well, actually, he's talking about the technological moment, he's talking about the relation to nature moment. There are people who, you read something like Paul Hawkins' book on Blessed Unrest, which is really about the dynamics of daily life. The people in daily life are changing the ways in which things are, and you can forget all the other stuff, because they're the ones who are actually generating the revolution, and it's a silent revolution because it's going on in the particular ways it's going on, and you don't have to be concerned about all these macro other issues, because people who want to talk about that are obviously misleading you. You then get, if you like, the social relations determinism. You know, feminists will say, well, if, you know, it's got to be the feminist, and of course, within Marx, we have the whole kind of notion that all history is the history of class struggle. Therefore, class struggle is going to be actually lead us into the promised land, and so on. So you could go around each one of these, and you could find at least a bundle of social theorists who will take one of these elements and treat it as if it is the silver bullet of change. They're all wrong. What you have to do is to think about this revolution, this co-evolutionary process and co-revolutionary process. Now, what this immediately says is that there are many ways in which we can start to think about a revolutionary movement. clearly the technological moment is important. And there are many people who have been working particularly on the new information technologies who are using to left-wing purposes and are talking about them from a left-wing standpoint, as a progressive standpoint, as one of the ways in which we might be able to appropriate a whole bunch of new technologies to a progressive cause. And that is absolutely right. But you cannot then say, well, that's all that matters. There has to be an alliance, if you will, between those people who are actually working in that technological domain and people who are working in, say, the social relations domain. And that alliance is not always well set up. Now, there are many people who will kind of say, well, we have to construct new social relations, but the interesting kind of question is, often those social relations are seen in a rather micro kind of way. That's the virtue of many people will see in somebody like Paul Hawking, who kind of say, well, you just work on these things in a kind of local kind of way and sort it out. And indeed, people do. There's no question the dynamics of that is very important. The big question is, how does that actually lead into transformations, which the global justice movement would want to ask, in which we can actually house, feed, nurture 6.5 billion people, 6.8 billion people who live on planet Earth right now? And how can many of these solutions, which have been worked out by the kind of on the ground sort of local kind of development, how can they be scaled up, to a different level? So there are issues of this kind which arise sort of all of the time. So what I'm going to suggest then is that actually what we need to be thinking of is the transformations of all of these elements, as well as we think about the kind of principles that might actually link together one moment with another moment. For example, in the field of social relations, suppose we came up with the idea that actually the norm to which we would try to aspire is radical egalitarianism in social relations. Many people on the left would agree with that. There's actually a long history of left movements that have actually thought about radical egalitarianism in social relations as being the foundation of a different kind of social order. Now, the big question then is not the radical egalitarianism, because it's how radical egalitarianism gets related to these other elements that I've talked about. For example, there are a lot of polls in this country that show that most Americans have a real yen for a radical egalitarianism. And actually, if you ask simple questions like, should everybody in the country have reasonable access to health care, the answer is 70 or 80% will say yes. Should they have access to educational opportunity? 70 or 80% will say yes. Again and again and again, and this goes back historically, the American Political Science Association did a huge kind of study, both on contemporary conditions but also looking backwards at polls, shows Americans are very much in favor of radical egalitarianism. And therefore, they will always respond positively if you ask the right kind of question about radical egalitarianism to say yes, 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 yes. That's the foundation of American life. The problem, however, is twofold. First, radical egalitarianism is associated with private property rights. And as soon as you associate radical egalitarianism with private property, you start to get inequalities. Now, there's an interesting kind of saying that there's nothing more unequal than the equal treatment of unequals. And actually, that's how the market works. The market is a very egalitarian device, very egalitarian in lots of ways. I have a dollar, you have a dollar, it's worth a dollar, and that's it. And we can both go and buy a dollar's worth of goods. So it's radically egalitarian in a certain way. But another way, when it's caught with the notion of private property rights and accumulation of asset values and accumulation of capital, then it immediately becomes something other than that. So part of the problem with the radical egalitarianism in the United States is that it's connected to the notion of private property rights and that individuality and private property are actually connected together. So this is a situation in which a norm in the realm of social relations confronts a norm in terms of institutional arrangements which means that the institutional arrangements frustrate, if you like, the radical egalitarianism to which many people would aspire. Now, this goes even further because it turns out the American Political Science Association survey showed that the other feature that is true of America is that most Americans are actually radically anti-authoritarian, which means they're anti-state. Therefore, by definition, you do not want the state under any circumstances to intervene in order to produce radical egalitarianism. And you can see this going on around the healthcare debate, for example. None of the Republicans say, I am against decent healthcare for every American. They say, of course I'm in favor of that. I'm a radical egalitarian too. I'm just radically opposed to the state having anything whatsoever to do with it. Again, it's that kind of process I was talking about earlier, that the means actually frustrate the ends. And in this instance, you have two things. You have the means, which are, you know, the market and the state, and both of those means are orchestrated in a certain way to take radical egalitarianism and then actually turn it into something which is incredible inequality. And that actually is the way in which those people who benefit from the inequality maintain their power. They articulate those particular ideas about the world, and this gets back then, if you like, to mental conceptions. For example, in urbanization in this country, one of the biggest things we have to confront is the power and ideology of home ownership. How significant that is. It's a mark of identity. I mean, I lived in this area of Baltimore for many years as a renter, and I'd walk down the street and nobody would say, I'd occasionally half smile at people and people look at me like I was, who the hell did I think I was, kind of thing. And then the landlady decided to sell the place and said she wanted to sell it to me because she knew I wouldn't speculate with it. I was terrified, I'd never been a homeowner before, and I was still am terrified by the whole thought, but in the end, I succumbed and I bought the place. But within 3 weeks of having bought the place, I walked down the block and people were saying, "Hi, how are you today?" I finally existed because I was an owner. When I was a renter, I didn't exist. Now this is not peculiar to this little neighborhood in Baltimore. I can tell you this is actually sort of part of the deeply embedded. Now, part of the problem, therefore, is that the myth of home ownership becomes absolutely fundamental. It's a mental conception of the world, which actually then powers much of what is going on politically. And what we've seen, of course, with the subprime crisis is holding out that dream of home ownership to all of those people who really didn't qualify for it and weren't really prepared for it. Holding out that dream and sucking them into that dream and then ripping them off left, right, and center. And this rip-off, by the way, was going on well before the subprime crisis broke. There's some very interesting data about what has been happening in African American communities around the United States in the period from about 1998 to about 2006, before the subprime thing really blew up. And the calculations are that the African American population lost somewhere between the order of $40 billion to $60 billion. During those years, from subprime predatory practices. And this was going on, and nobody was going to take any notice of it. It was certainly going on in Baltimore, it was already going on in Cleveland, and nobody was taking any notice of it. It was only when it sort of started, really blowing up, and some of the middle class started getting involved in, Southern California and other sort of places, that people really started to take notice. But again, why were people caught into this? Well, it had a lot to do with this mythology of home ownership. And the mythology has also a political thing. I mean, the original years in which home ownership began to be promoted very heavily was in the 1930s. I mean, I think it's around 1937, the Housing Act of 1937 constructed a possibility where you could get a 30-year mortgage. Before that, you could only get a 3-year mortgage at best, and then you had to refinance. Always a sort of tricky business. But look at what was going on in the 1930s. You get these massive strikes in the late 1930s. And so one of the responses is to come up with this kind of home ownership thing. And at the time, it was said very directly that debt-encumbered homeowners don't go on strike. This was very much about a social control mechanism, a political control mechanism. And actually that goes back to Britain in the 1920s. I mean, my colleague Neil Smith has this great poster where it's about the building societies in Britain, which were being supported by the government to bring home ownership to working class population. And the ad kind of said that the building societies were the best defense against Bolshevism. And you can see how a private property kind of question and identity question then gets involved. Now, one of the issues I think that we're confronted with, particularly on the urban side, is the whole kind of question of how do we come up with different forms of ownership, housing security, not necessarily personal individual ownership, but collective forms. Are there, you know, without necessarily going inside of the state apparatus, are there collective forms? And this is one of the issues that we need to give some very, very serious thought to. And that's not the kind of thing that can be necessarily worked out at the level of a community association, however good it can be at actually revolutionizing certain aspects of social relations within a certain part of the city. It has then to do with trying to set up, actually transform institutional arrangements. And that means you need an alliance with some of the people who know about how to construct social institutional arrangements. Because the difficulty, it seems to me, is that one of the issues we face is that you can't actually change from a capitalist world into a socialist or a communist world overnight. That actually you have to try to construct an alternative social order on the basis of the institutional arrangements which currently exist, the technologies which currently exist, the social relations that currently exist, the mental conceptions that currently exist. These differ a great deal from one part of the country to another, from one place to another, and they also differ a great deal between countries. That is, a revolutionary movement in Chiapas, for example, is going to look very different from a revolutionary movement here in New York City. And much as we may admire what the Zapatistas have done, there's no point kind of saying somehow or other we can bring all of their solutions here. We can't do that. We have to think about the dynamics of how do we change this system on the basis of what currently exists. And now there's a certain geography to all of that. And that means that therefore, again, it's not that the kinds of solutions that are promoted, say, in this part of the world, where they can inspire us in certain ways, can be actually translated. We have to think about, analyze our own particular situation in our own particular place and time, and then think about how the movement can be set in motion between those different elements in a different kind of dynamic, and what kinds of alliances can be constructed. And what we find in something like the Right to the City Alliance if you like, a coming together of different groups with different agendas, but a recognition that somehow or other those different groups with different agendas can actually start talking to each other around what they have in common, and that they can see a common basis for many of their difficulties. That gentrification produces homelessness, that homelessness is associated with street harassment, which is associated with an incarceration politics. Therefore, there are a very clear basis, if you like, for all sorts of alliances between different elements in that, so that that alliance can build in a different way and say, housing provision, the state approach in terms of social relations to homelessness, and harassment on public spaces and all the rest of it, that those issues can all be actually seen as part and parcel of a very general problematic in which we have actually, what Henri Lefebvre called an urban basis for a revolutionary transformation. Now transformations, revolutionary transformations, and again I would go back to the way in which Marx talked about it in terms of the transition from feudalism to capitalism, those transformations take many years. It took many years for capitalism to arrive at its own distinctive form of social relations, its own distinctive technologies, its own distinctive institutional arrangements. And we have to also recognize that we're in this for the long haul, that actually there is a long process, but in that long process we have to actually concentrate on the relationships between the different movements, different moments. And to me, one of the failures of past attempts to construct communism have precisely been about a failure to keep the movement going. that the movement has to be a movement across all of those elements, across the technology and the social relations and the mental conceptions. It cannot actually remain in any one of those moments. So there's absolutely nothing wrong beginning your revolutionary moment in the technological sphere, in the relation to nature, in the social relations. There's nothing wrong whatsoever with starting there. The big problem is if you stay there. And the big problem is if you stay there on your own, as if the other moments don't matter, or even worse, you start criticizing those people for working on the other moments when they should be working on yours. And it is therefore, if you like, the whole kind of structure of alliances which are going to be built that seems to me to be crucial to starting to think about revolutionary transformation of our kind of society into something rather different. And again, there is a distinctive geography to all of this. One of the things we may well find is that revolutionary transformations in one part of the world don't gel at all with revolutionary transformations in another. Some will complement, some will conflict. That is the way in which actually, again, capitalism evolved out of feudalism. And we should not be afraid of those conflicts, and we should not be concerned that somehow or other we don't get, you know, we can't be utopic in the sense of saying, well, somehow or other, once we get the idea that everywhere is going to sort of move in lock, stock and barrel, it's not going to work that way. There's going to be an uneven geographical development of revolutionary impulses, as there already is, and you can already see that very clearly if you look at across Latin America, and you look into South Africa and India, India is seething with all kinds of revolutionary transformative movements right now. So if you start to look at these, and you say, well, you know, what are they doing? Well, we can draw inspiration, but not necessarily sort of say, well, they've got it right, and we don't. The question is, how do we actually transform the world in our space and our time? And how do we go about it? Well, a general theory of social change is necessary, but also practical engagement on the ground. And it is that link, if you like, between having this general idea in one's head at the same time as we're prepared to go for things on the ground. When Take Back the Land says we've got to take back the land, yes, let's do it, because that's a crucial means of production. When the Right to the City say we've got to actually take back the right to the city, yes, let's do it. In other words, there's plenty of movement in motion right now, but it's very important as we go forward in that movement to have this more general, and I think more generous interpretation of what it is that other people might be engaged in and what other people might be doing. Because if we have that more generous interpretation, we will possibly not only be able to appreciate what other people are doing, but also at the same time build alliances with what other people are doing and use those alliances to push the whole system in a different dimension to what it's going in. We are still in the midst of a crisis, in spite of the fact that Ben Bernanke says, you know, we've got green shoots all over the place. Actually, back in 2004, I'd like to remind you, he said the system is now so deep and so wide that there's absolutely no systemic risk whatsoever, and that therefore we've eradicated all possibilities of any kind of major upset. And he said that in 2004. And so you should remember that every time he comes up and says, hey, there are green shoots around right now, because he is as skeptical of the one as he should be of the other. So we are in and capitalism is itself trying to come out of this crisis without changing anything. What it's trying to do is to sort of reconstruct the system as we went into it. It's actually re-empowering all of the people who got us into this mess, and not in any way, if you like, really undergoing any radical transformation. I don't think it's going to work. I think even if it works temporarily, as it may do in terms of the political business cycle, that they'll try and bolster the economy sufficiently for Democrats to get re-elected in time, that kind of thing. Even if they can get these little blips in it which push it upwards and make it seem like it's getting better, I think we are in for a rather long 5 or 6 years before there's any kind of redefinition. And during those 5 or 6 years, I think we have a real big opportunity to try to turn the system around and shove it in a different direction, which it seems to me that is what Marx and Engels outlined as being central in the Communist Manifesto back in 1848, and I don't see any reason why we shouldn't stick with that. Let me leave it there. Thanks so much.